Good afternoon, everyone. Please be seated. Today is our first day of hearings in the Nevada Court of Appeals. We had oral argument this morning on two cases, both civil cases. So this is the very first criminal case to be argued. So it's a continuation of the historic day that we've been experiencing, and I hope you all appreciate that being here, and you're going to enjoy this experience. We're actually very nice. As you know, we're all trial court judges, and I have Judge Jerome Tao to my left, Department 1 of the Court of Appeals, and Judge Abby Silver to my right, Department 3 of the Court of Appeals. Have any of you not been in front of these two judges before?
You've been in front of us lots and lots of times.
So first for me, probably. So I'm Michael Gibbons. I'm from the north, but I spend a lot of time in the south, too. All right, so we have the next case to be heard is 64539. That's Noel Gonzalez versus State of Nevada. This is appeal from a judgment of conviction in Clark County, jury verdict. And there are a number of issues raised on appeal, so we, of course, start with the appellant, and it's Marty Levy.
Good afternoon. May it please the Honorable Court, my name is Monty Levy, and I'm here representing the appellant Noel Gonzalez. If I may, I would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, and I'd like to begin with the insufficiency of the evidence for the kidnapping conviction. The movement of Ms. Tamaya, the victim in our case, was only for the purpose of robbery. There is no independent significance, and the risk of harm to Ms. Tamaya was not substantially increased by the movement. Therefore, the conviction for kidnapping must be reversed. In order to sustain a dual conviction for a kidnapping and robbery, the restraint or movement of the victim must stand alone with independent significance apart from the robbery itself. The restraint or movement must create a risk of danger to the victim substantially exceeding that necessarily present in the crime of robbery, or it must involve movement, seizure, or restraint substantially in excess of that necessary to complete the robbery. None of those conditions were present in our case.
Isn't there an argument to be made that the movement or the aspiration of the victim in this case from the garage into the home where she could not be seen by anybody, isn't it at least arguable to the jury that increased the risk of harm?
Well, the risk of harm in this case was that there was a gun. And in the garage, the gun was pointed at Ms. Tamaya. So the risk of harm is that the trigger is going to be pulled. That risk does not substantially increase just by moving into the house. The risk of harm is the same. I'm either going to pull the trigger or I'm not.
The case law, taking the victim to yet another location, that is the part that increases the risk of harm, not the fact that they have a gun on them from one spot to the next. It's taking them to a more secret location where they arguably can't be rescued.
Well, the test is that it substantially increased the risk of harm. And just moving into the house doesn't substantially increase the risk of harm. It's not whether or not she's going to be rescued. The harm is that the gun's going to be fired. The harm is that she's going to be shot. And that risk of that happening is not substantially increased just by moving into the home.
Mental construct, one way to maybe think about this is to compare what happened with what could have been done. What could have been done is they go up to her in the garage, point a gun at her, keep her in the garage, sort of hold her there while the other guys go through the house. And can't the argument be made that as long as she's in a public place, it's a little bit less likely that they're going to shoot her, because in the garage, if they fire the gun, the entire neighborhood is going to hear it, versus in the house, if they fire the gun, maybe no one's going to hear it?
Well, that's not really the facts of this case, because when they move her into the home, the risk of harm actually decreased, because when you look at the facts of this case, the gun is pointed on her in the garage. When they move into the home, Ms. Tamaya testified that at no point at all during that being in the house was the gun ever pointed at her, and in fact she's told that nobody's going to harm her. So I guess the argument could be made that the suspects are more likely to shoot her in the home, but that's not the facts of this case. When you're looking at the kidnap robbery. It's every case on its own is different. You have to look at the facts of this specific case. And in this case, the risk of the defendant's shooting Ms. DeMaia did not substantially increase by moving into the house. In fact, the argument could be made that it, in fact, decreased because the gun is pointed at her in the garage, but when they're in the house, the gun is never pointed at her. So I understand Your Honor's concern, but in this case, that's not what we have. And we're not, and Your Honor indicated we're in a public place, but we're not in a public place. We're still in a garage. Although the garage door is open, there was no evidence that there was a crowded street, that anyone was around. It's a work day in the middle of the week, so there wasn't that, it wasn't like a public parking lot, and then she's moved to a secluded place. So it didn't substantially increase the risk of harm from moving her from her garage into the house. And that's the test. It's a substantial increase, not just whether it could have increased. It must have, in that case, substantially increased.
One fact that's a little different in this case is that there's a small child in the home, and the victim is fearful for what might happen to her daughter, and if she's away from her child, then she's going through this fear. Does fear play into the kidnapping at all, or does it only have to be the risk of danger?
Well, fear plays only into the robbery. For the kidnap robbery analysis, fear of the victim does not play into it. The test is simply, does the movement itself substantially increase the victim's risk of harm? And in this case, it did not.
Does it make any difference that there's a child there and she's kept away from the child?
No, and she's not kept away from her child. In fact, when she's approached in the garage, she's away from her child. Her child was napping inside the home. When they go in the home, at some point she hears her child. She wants to go to her child. And she is allowed to eventually go get her child. And she has her child, and she's able to escape. So in this case, none of the factors for the kidnap robbery exist. It did not substantially increase her risk of harm, the movement. And the movement was necessary to complete the robbery. Ms. DeMaia initially is in the garage when she's approached by the three individuals. She's told right away that they want her money. A gun is pointed at her in the garage. The female suspect makes the motion with her head to go into the home. Ms. DeMaia enters the house, and she, on her own, goes to the master bedroom. She's followed by the suspects. They go and they ransack her bedroom. They start taking her belongings. All throughout the time in the house, she's repeatedly asked, where's the guns, where's the money? She's taken to the safe and asked to open the safe. Now, that movement was necessary to complete the robbery. They could not have gotten into the safe had they not moved Ms. DeMaia and opened the safe.
Do you think the jury was properly instructed on the elements of both crimes, and therefore the jury was able to assess whether there was something different about the kidnapping? There were more elements that had to be met? I mean, how did this verdict happen if the instructions were appropriate?
I believe that the jury was properly instructed under the law, which is the Mendoza case, which is controlling. But I don't believe that the jury fully understood the concept of what's necessary to have a dual conviction for a robbery and a kidnapping.
Did you file a writ in this case with the district court ahead of time to because you're basically what you're saying is, as a matter of law, that this should have been resolved because it merged together. It was just a robbery. It was not a robbery and a kidnapping.
Right.
So my question is, was a writ filed for a district court to make the determination that, as a matter of law, in fact, it was incidental to the robbery?
No, a writ was not filed in this case attacking the probable cause finding.
Not the probable cause, but also to also determine, well, as a matter of law, I guess, or a motion to dismiss.
Right.
To dismiss that count of kidnapping.
We did not file a writ in this case.
So you allowed it to go to the jury as a jury question of whether or not there was a substantial risk of harm to that victim, and the jury answered it.
Correct, but we believe that the jury got it wrong in this case. With the facts that we have in this case, the movement of Ms. DeMaia was necessary to complete the robbery. They could not have gotten the money and the belongings in the safe had they not moved Ms. DeMaia. Moving from the garage into the house and throughout the house did not increase the risk of harm. And the Nevada Supreme Court has looked at this on a number of occasions. And in the Wright case, Wright versus State, the Nevada Supreme Court looked at when you can have a dual conviction for robbery and kidnapping. And if you literally apply the kidnapping statute, what the Nevada Supreme Court held was that it would be almost impossible to conceive of a situation where a robbery would not result in a kidnapping. And this, the court stated that the statute is so broad in its sweep that literally applied, it would encompass an ordinary robbery in the course of which the victim happens to be moved from one room to another, which is the case we have here. And that's not what was intended by the legislature. And in the Wright case, in fact, after the belongings were taken, the defendants ordered the victims to lay down on face down, and they taped their hands and feet. And that was found to be incidental to the robbery. That was not found to be a kidnapping, and the kidnapping convictions were reversed.
Describe the aspiration in that case. It's in that case, room, they safe to save.
Yes. In that case, three young men robbed the Ambassador Motel at gunpoint. They ordered the victims to the back office. Eventually, they told the victims to lie face down, and the robbers taped their hands and feet. And the Wright court held that this detention of the victims was necessary to complete the robbery, and the kidnapping convictions were reversed. And in this case, the legislature did not intend for it to be a dual conviction of robbery and kidnapping. And the penalty, and the Wright court even acknowledged that the penalty for robbery is significantly less severe than that for kidnapping. And in this case, Mr. Gonzalez was punished on the kidnapping alone to life imprisonment with eligibility for parole after 5 years, plus a consecutive term of 2 to 10 years, on top of what he received for the robbery with use of a deadly weapon. Like the Wright case, the detention of Mr. Maya was only for the short period of time necessary to consummate the robbery.
Is this test both subjective and objective, or just objective? The way you're arguing it, you're just saying, look, she was moved from room to room. There's another case where they're moved from room. Does it matter what the victim thinks or what the victim is afraid might be going on, for example, with her child? Or are you saying that's just irrelevant? We just compare the facts in a cold-hearted, objective way from case to case, and what the victim thinks might happen, what the victim feels might happen is not even a factor?
I don't believe what the victim feels is a factor. It's whether or not the risk substantially increased, or whether the movement was above and beyond which was needed to complete the robbery. So under that test, it doesn't appear to me that the case law supports that the victim's thought process are taken into consideration. I know I'm almost out of time, but I did want to move on to the...
Ms. Levy, if you want to reserve any time for rebuttal, you can't bring up new issues. So if you could just identify the other issues and talk about them really fast if you want to save the rebuttal time.
Okay. The other issue that I wanted to speak of, and with the hearsay issue, I'll submit that on the brief, but I did want to turn to the issue of the suppression of Mr. Gonzalez's statement, which appears to me to be almost a novel issue in the state of Nevada. Mr. Gonzalez's language difficulties as a non-native English speaker impaired his ability to freely and voluntarily waive his rights under Miranda. When questioning non-native English-speaking suspects who are detained, law enforcement must employ extra precautions to ensure that the individual fully understands the important rights under the Constitution before deciding whether to waive those rights. And that was not done in this case. Detective Flynn interrogated Mr. Gonzalez and spoke to him only in English, and he spoke very slow and deliberate until he gets to Miranda, and then he zips through the Miranda warning. So with a non-native English speaker, the court, when looking at the totality of the circumstances, should adopt the factors set forth in the Ninth Circuit case of U.S. v. Garibay, and I know I'm almost out of time, so I'd like to reserve the rest of the time for rebuttal, but I did want to raise that issue so I'd be able to talk about it afterwards.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. All right, you've reserved 3 minutes then for a rebuttal. All right, and is Ms. Thompson?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, welcome. We heard a very good argument, and I'm expecting a very good response. Go ahead.
May it please the Court, I will follow the same order in which Ms. Levy presented the issues. Speaking of the robbery, it is absolutely the state's position that the jury did find, beyond a reasonable doubt, that the movement increased the risk of harm, that there was sufficient evidence for them to do so. As was noted, she was taken out of the relative safety of the open garage, where this was a neighborhood that was testified was a more developed neighborhood. It had more people on the street. It was the middle of the day. There were often cars that would pass by, taken from a place where she could be seen. We know that her neighbor's front door could see the front of her house, and into the home at gunpoint with a gun that we know from when it was collected was already ready to be used. It was already a bullet in the chamber. Additionally, inside the home, there were further guns collected, further guns to be looked for, making a possibility and an opportunity for each of the co-conspirators to then have a weapon and use that weapon against Ms. Tamaya. In addition to being moved into the home, notably, the door was locked by the co-conspirators from the garage into the home, again, making it more difficult for her to leave and increasing that risk of harm. As she's now outside the view of passerby, she has a limited opportunity to be able to seek help, to have anyone come to her aid. To the extent
you go into how the aspiration, though, of the victim increased her risk of harm, not once she's inside the house. At that point, arguably, if a kidnapping has occurred, it's already occurred.
The actual movement of her increased the risk of harm because that's where the gun is pointed at her. That's the opportunity that she has to get away, and that's the time where, and it plays into the question of does fear have any element in kidnapping. I don't believe, and I would say that the law doesn't sustain a victim who's more afraid is more kidnapped, but objectively, an afraid individual will react differently, and the reactions of the victims will associate to what kind of risk there is.
That's not been looked at, though, by the Nevada Supreme Court, the victim's fear. It's more how that movement of the victim has somehow increased a risk of harm that it makes it a separate and distinct crime.
Taking her instead of leaving her out where she could be seen, taking her to a place where she could not be seen, absolutely increased the risk of harm. Looking at what happened in the house helps us to see that. The fact that we have different people in different locations, giving her separate orders in contradiction of each other, where she's now in a place where she can't do anything right, and that obviously is going to put her in a place where there is the possibility of a response from those co-conspirators, making her in a more tenuous situation. Excuse me. The argument that she was necessary for that robbery does not hold water. Looking at the actual facts of what happened, she indicated to the robbers over and over again, I don't know where anything is, I don't know where the money is, I don't know where the guns are. She indicated in testimony that her husband had moved the guns and she didn't know where they were. It wasn't until one of them had found the gun that she was aware of where it had been. To make the argument that she was necessary for the items from the safe, first of all, when they were in the garage, they had no idea that there was a safe in the house. Furthermore, the testimony was that when that safe was found in the bedroom closet, it was picked up and thrown on the floor. And what that tells us is the safe could easily have left the house and been dealt with in terms of opening and removing its contents at another time. She was not necessary for that robbery. The robbery took nearly an hour if we look at the time that she indicated she was out in the garage, which was an estimate, to the time that was an estimate of when Detective Cruz received the call and Detective Flynn received the calls to go out to the crime. During that period of time, which I would not describe as a brief incident, there were any number of opportunities for things to go sideways. And when you bring someone from the safety of the street into a concealed, confined area, with a weapon, that absolutely increases the risk of harm, and that's what the jury found in this case, and there was sufficient evidence.
You think that time is a really important factor then?
I think it's a very important factor. I think it is a factor that can be considered. Okay. I think if it were a movement that were, for example, as was referenced in Wright, where they're taken into the back room and put in the back room and then left there, that's not the same kind of a situation where you're then under supervision, you're being given direction, you're at the whim of individuals who are conflicting each other, who are giving you commands, giving you demands, and have a weapon that is readily available and easily used against you. I believe that this is different than Wright in that, if for nothing else, in Wright, the individuals were already concealed within the building. There was not that openness that is a huge factor in this case.
In this case, she's not in the street. She's in the garage. And I haven't obviously seen this garage, but some garages are they're quasi-private, especially if you've got a lot of stuff there, a bunch of cars, and I don't know exactly what this garage looked like, but my point is it's not exactly they took her from, you know, Walmart into a house. She's sort of in her house already.
The photographs were admitted for the jury. They were able to observe that this garage did open out to the street. The suspect's vehicle was parked in a position that did not block even her view from the street. When she moved out of the back passenger seat of the vehicle, which was pulled nose into the garage, she would have been easily visible from the street, and that can be seen in the photographs that were given to the jury as part of the exhibits in this case.
So do you think the longer the time, the more likely it's a kidnapping? Or is it the robbery could have been completed in a lesser time, and since the robbery lasted longer than it had to last, that then makes it a kidnapping, if you're just focusing on the time part of it right now, not the aspiration?
The detention absolutely exceeded what was necessary for them to gather items that they ultimately took. I don't believe that the time is a factor in sort of that bright line evaluation of increased harm, but it is one of those circumstances that I think is important to look at, because there's no, each case is a case-by-case basis, and based upon that, a situation that has an extensive period of time is going to necessarily be different than a situation that is a minute and a half.
But that may be arguably a second-degree kidnapping if you're talking about just within the home and holding somebody against their will, rather than first degree.
Absolutely. However, in this case, the jury was given sufficient evidence for them to be able to determine that that movement was for the purpose of robbery, and it's the state's position, well, obviously we don't know exactly what was in the minds of the jurors, but the weight of the evidence did support that it increased substantially the risk of harm to the victim when she was moved into the house. Moving on to...
And that's how you pled it as well. The aspiration was from the garage into the home.
Yes, Your Honor. Moving on to the issue of Miranda, there's a sort of two distinct portions that need to be evaluated. The first is whether or not the defendant was in a state where his waiver of that Miranda was a product of free will and deliberate choice. And the totality of the circumstances in this case showed that he was aware of the rights he was waiving, and that is true by a preponderance of the evidence. Looking at the totality of the circumstances, we know that both of his parents spoke some English, as two unrelated detectives had contact with his parents with the defendant present and observed both of his parents speaking to him in English. Further, there was an indication through the hearing that was held on the Jackson v. Deno hearing, I apologize, that the father appeared to be Caucasian, and at no time did anyone hear the father speak in Tagalog. We know that that's the same house that the defendant lived in. Furthermore, we know through the testimony of Dr. Paglini that the defendant appeared to be above average, or at least average intellect. And
but Paglini also says that about 50 to 70% of the time, Gonzalez could respond in English, but would need the interpreter to translate questions for him.
He also indicated that his recollection was that a large portion of what needed translation was the legal terms, and that about 50% of his evaluation involved legal terms, because the whole issue of the evaluation is whether or not he's competent to stand trial. It's not the other kinds of evaluations that can be performed. When we look at the testimony of Dr. Paglini, we also have the fact that the defendant had finished high school. We know from the interview that was actually given that that was not here in the United States. But comparing that with the testimony of Ms. Dooley, which was also presented by defense, she indicated that she had grown up in the Philippines, which is where the defendant is from, and that they had taught English from elementary on, which gives us another factor to look at his experience, his exposure to English. Perhaps the most important thing in terms of this very subjective, whether he understood, is looking at the history he has with contact with law enforcement. At the November 15th taped interview, we know that before that he had at least three times heard the Miranda warning. Most importantly was the taped interview with Detective Turquez on the 31st, where we actually have a transcript of what the warning was that he was given. In addition to being given the basic, as we all know, the Miranda warning, which is given to people across this country on a daily basis, whether they be doctors or they be people who have not finished high school, It is the warning that he gave, and then he further went on, and that's transcribed within the appellate appendix on page 397, to give specifics of, you can have an attorney, and we will pay for it. It won't be at a cost to you, and if you choose to have an attorney, they can be here for questioning. They can be here before questioning. You don't have to answer any more questions once you have the attorney. If you don't want to talk to us, we won't ask you any more questions. Not using the terms that were questioned by Josephina Dooley, not using the terms that were questioned by the defense motion, not using waiver, not using right. Of note was the fact that when there was a interaction with Ms. Dooley on the stand where she was indicating how she would explain terms that don't have a direct translation, she was given the opportunity to explain how she would describe waiver. And she said, well, I will tell them you waive your right. That means you can't exercise this right again, which is interesting given that she also said that there's no translation for the word right to mean privilege directly into that language. Looking at the fact that he had had this waive, this warning.
Ms. Thompson, what do you think? Ms. Levy said this was a novel area. There isn't any real case law on this. So you have terms that are in English, we have these legal terms. The native language doesn't have that same legal right. There is no such term. So you have some sort of interpretation by the interpreter as to how to explain what that legal term is.
And I would agree that that's an issue if you have an interpreter or someone who is making the warning into another language during the interview. But here we have one where the warning was given in English. He indicated all four times that we are aware of that he understood it, and he had previously had it explained to him in even different words than are the words that are suspect, according to the testimony of Ms. Dooley.
So the doctor, I believe it was Dr. Paglini, said, you know, there were problems on those legal terms explaining that to, you know, Mr. Gonzalez.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that same problem then carry over to the earlier point in time when he's being interviewed by the police? I mean, if the doctor saw it and the police, you know, they say he seems to understand what we're saying, but how do they really know that he knows what those terms mean?
First, I would argue, one, that waiver does not particularly change the context. And if we look at the rights as they are traditionally read, that we all hear on television that the police read off of their cards, if you take out the word right or privilege and you replace it with pretty much any other word, the meaning is still conveyed. You have the to remain silent. You have the for an attorney. If you cannot afford one, one will be appointed to you. Taking that word out does not change the meaning that is conveyed. And that is specifically notable given the fact that he throughout the interview indicates, I understand. He indicates answers that are responsive to the questions that are coherent. And to say that he only says yes because he doesn't understand ignores the fact that at the end of the interview he's asked, is there anything you didn't understand? And he doesn't say yes. He says, no, I understood everything. So to come back later and say, I just said yes, ignores his own words. And it puts the court by saying, well, we have to figure out if they're lying to us about understanding, in a position where the court and the officers must then have sort of this insight into their minds and speculate about what it is that they are thinking and their motivations for giving the statement that they give.
What about the statements he gave at the scene?
The ones up when he came up to Detective Cruz? Those were not subject of Miranda because he's not in custody, he's not being interrogated. He comes up and he's just volunteering, let me tell you all about what I did. That shows his intent to actually speak with officers. It also is reflected even when he comes into court. There's conversation in, or argument in the motions to suppress about how he gave inappropriate statements at his initial arraignment. And if Your Honors review that initial arraignment, it's interesting because the inappropriate statement is when he's asked how he pleads no contest. Now, is that an answer that we would typically expect? No, but does it make it inappropriate? No, it actually is very consistent with him. If we look through his history and what we have in the record, he's agreeable, he's cooperative. The police all say he wanted to tell me more. In each of the interviews, he starts telling the police about crimes they don't even know about. So to say that he's non-responsive is an inaccurate assessment of what's actually happening. What it is that he's not getting the answer that we have all come to expect, but it doesn't make it the wrong answer. There was no coercive behavior by the police officers to result in the statement he gave. He was given water. He was asleep when they came in, but it was 7:30 at night. He was not given any promises. He wasn't made any threats. There was no physical behavior that in any way forced him to say the things he said. To characterize the Miranda that was given to him as being zipped through, that is obviously going to be a subjective, and my understanding is you all had the opportunity to review the video and the audio of that. The Miranda...
Is there any indication that drugs played a role in this?
Mm-hmm. My response to that would be no. There have been cases after case... There's been case after case that talks about the effect of alcohol, the effect of drugs. In this case, every response that he gave was coherent. And if we look at that statement and the timeline, we can see that there had been several hours since his last report of ingestion. In addition, we know that there could not have been any more ingestion since the beginning of the crime, which put us at, my recollection, is about 5 hours since the beginning of the crime to the beginning of the interview.
Okay. Any of the other judges have questions? Okay. All right, Ms. Thompson, I forgot to ask you to introduce your co-counsel.
I apologize. This is Elizabeth Anderling. She is the individual who wrote our briefs.
Oh, well, thank you. So she's part of this historic proceeding then today, too. I have to make sure her name is included, too.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Real brief, in response to the kidnap and robbery, the state's indicating that the movement, because it moved her from the garage into the home where she can't be seen, that that increased the risk of harm to her. Again, the risk of harm is that the gun's going to be fired. Moving her to the house does not substantially increase that risk of harm. Just moving her where she can't be seen is not enough. And we know that because when you look at the Wright case, in the Wright case, the victims were in a hotel lobby. They're moved to a back office where they cannot be seen by the public. And in that case, the movement and the taping of their hands and feet was not enough to sustain the dual convictions for kidnap and robbery. So it's not enough just to take them from a place where they could have been seen in a hotel lobby into a back office where they cannot be seen. Just like here, it's not enough to move to sustain the kidnapping, to move Ms. DeMaia from her garage to the robbery.
Let me tell you, I didn't get a chance to follow because you ran out of time originally, but I asked you the subjective versus objective component. This is where I was going with it. Does the fact that she's a woman matter in the sense that by moving her into the house, unlike if she were a man, she might be thinking, or it might be possible that they're going to commit another crime, possibly sexual assault on her in the house that they couldn't do in the garage. Is that something that we can consider to the extent that it's not objective when you compare to other cases, but it's subjective because you talk about the gender of the victim. Is that something that you would think that we can even consider or not?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and even the state conceded that these facts must be taken on a case-by-case basis. Did that increase the risk of harm in this case? No. The movement itself did not increase the risk of harm. With these suspects, it decreased the risk of harm. The gun was put down. Nobody pointed a gun at her in the house. There was there's a female suspect and two male suspects. The victim, what's in her mind, it's whether or not the risk of harm substantially is increased by that movement. Just moving Ms. DeMaia into the home does not substantially increase the risk of harm with the facts of this case.
If that was as a matter of law, though, for us to reverse a jury's determination of that, did you also file a motion for a judgment for acquittal?
We did not. We did not file one in this case. But if you look at the Wright case and the facts of that case, moving them from an open lobby to a back room, that was not sufficient. Same argument that the state just made, that, just moving her from the garage where she could have been seen, that's enough. It's not, and you look at the right case, and it's absolutely not enough. With regard to Mr. Gonzalez's statement, the court should look at and should adopt the factors that were outlined in Garibay. Because this is a novel issue, there is no case law directly on point. And in the Garibay case, what they looked at is whether or not the defendant signed a written waiver, and he did not. Whether he was advised of his rights in his native tongue, and he was not. Whether he appeared to understand his rights. And that's where it's important to look back at the testimony of Ms. Dooley, who has...
Here's the thing. Garibay is a 1998 case, and the Supreme Court's had a lot of Miranda voluntariness-type cases, and they've never adopted Garibay, despite the fact that it's almost a 20-year-old case now. Isn't that a sign that the Supreme Court doesn't intend to adopt Garibay?
I could not find any case law published opinion in Nevada that dealt with a language issue with a Miranda and the voluntariness issue. And it has to be looked at de novo. And so I would ask the court to reread Ms. Dooley's testimony and Dr. Langkite and Dr. Paglini's. And I know I'm out of time.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Levy.
Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate it.
Counsel for both parties did an excellent job. We appreciate it. We were commenting amongst ourselves this morning that having the oral argument was very helpful to better understand the issues in the case. That's why we set them. And in this situation, once again, it's very helpful to have the presentation from both sides. So this matter will stand submitted for a decision at a later point in time.